there is a full scale, that is a life-size transparency, color transparency of the shroud, which one can see in Turin Cathedral today, which is said to be rather accurate. And it shows a rather discolored linen cloth, and on this is a faint image, which has slight quality of, let's say, dried blood. And it's rather mysterious because at first you may not see the image of the figure of Christ, but as you stand and stare in greater detail, it begins to emerge. And most importantly, I think, for the faithful, both today and in the past, is that the major wounds on the figure of Christ are very visible. That is, you can see the nails in the feet and in the hands, and the spear wound in the side, and the marks from the crown of thorns that were placed on the brow.
Art historian John Scott. Apropos of Easter 1995, he'll be back in just a moment to discuss the Shroud of Turin, one of the most sacred of Christian relics. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial funding for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Of all the relics of early Christianity that survive into the modern world, the Shroud of Turin is certainly one of the most important. For the faithful, it testifies to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The Shroud also acts as a magnet for scholars interested in its social and cultural implications. Among them is John Belden Scott, a professor of art history at the University of Iowa. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, John Belden Scott worked on a new study of the Shroud of Turin. He's here now with an overview of that project.
The Shroud of Turin is a linen cloth about 14 feet long and 3.5 feet wide. And on this cloth is imprinted a faint russet-toned image of two figures placed head-to-head lengthwise. One is a frontal figure, and one is of the back of the figure.
How old is this? Do we call it a piece of textile or cloth?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. How far back does it go?
The oldest historical documents that we can attach to the object which is today in Turin date back to the mid-14th century.
Mm-hmm. That would be what? About the end of the so-called Middle Ages.
Yes, moving toward the late Middle Ages, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. All right, now, if the scientific evidence comes to us from, I believe you said 1988, you had this carbon dating exercise that occurred, we have a real disparity here between the origins of the Shroud of Turin that purportedly take us back in time to the world of antiquity, and what you've just told me here, that is to say the Middle Ages, for the time when this relic originates. How about this?
Yes, in fact, the carbon-14 dating analysis, which was conducted in 1988, actually corroborate the historical documents, that is, written texts that refer to the relic in Turin. So that skeptics have said that concludes the issue. However, it might be said that even those scientists who conducted the analysis at Zurich, at the University of Arizona, and Oxford, note that there is a margin of error in this procedure. Likewise, the documents, the written documents from the 14th century have been analyzed, and some people think they are forgeries. In any case, they are certainly copies, not the original.
Mm-hmm. All right, now again, the Shroud of Turin appears to be the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. This obviously would have enormous importance as a matter of scientific investigation, as a matter of historical scholarship, as a matter of faith. Mm-hmm. How do you work your way through those very imposing challenges? How do you come to the Shroud of Turin as a scholar? Why is it important to you?
Well, as an architectural historian, I'm looking at the chapels that were built to house and exhibit the relic. So in a way, I'm looking at the worldly history, mm-hmm. the sort of secular side of the object and how it fits into the political dynamics of a later period. But, of course, this cannot be detached from the spiritual significance that was seen in the object, especially in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, which are the periods, which include the period that I'm working on.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that political history, that sort of secular recitation in just a moment, John. But let me get back to the shroud itself for a moment. Tell me what it looks like. Go into some detail for me.
Well, the I should say, first off, that one rarely has an opportunity to see the object since it's rolled up and kept in a silver jewel-encrusted reliquary. But and I have not seen it myself. There is a full scale, that is a life-size transparency, color transparency of the shroud, which one can see in Turin Cathedral today, which is said to be rather accurate. And it shows a rather discolored linen cloth, and on this is a faint image which has slight quality of, let's say, dried blood. And it's rather mysterious because at first you may not see the image of the figure of Christ, but as you stand and stare in greater detail, it begins to emerge. And most importantly, I think, for the faithful, both today and in the past, is that the major wounds on the figure of Christ are very visible. That is, you can see the nails in the feet and in the hands, and the spear wound in the side, and the marks from the crown of thorns that were placed on the brow.
Now, there must be, a kind of an industry behind all of the explanations for the Shroud of Turin, running the gamut all the way from the utterly agnostic people who do not believe, who want to disprove, to the other end of the gamut, that is to say, people for whom this is the real thing. This is the burial cloth of Jesus himself.
That's right. Let me give you, for example, what was generally held to be the understanding in the period that I'm working, 16th through 18th centuries. And there were many Christians who had other alternative explanations as well. But it was generally believed that the image that we see on the shroud was made from the blood on the body of Christ.
Burned into the cloth,
yes,
so to speak.
And this is very important because because of the theological significance of the blood of Christ. And that places the Shroud of Turin above almost all other relics. It's not just a relic of a saint, but it has the actual blood of Christ on
now,
it.
Now, we live in a world where relics, let's put it this way, in North American society, relics don't necessarily have the force that for other populations in the world they may still have. In fact, they're really very distant from us. We live in the world of digital watches and computers, and yet this relic continues to carry an enormous importance for those who believe.
That's right. The Shroud of Turin has been particularly intriguing because it has seemed, at least since 1898 when it was exhibited, that it might be possible to use forms of scientific analysis to demonstrate factually, with science, the actual passion of Christ.
Now, has that happened?
let me tell you a little bit about what happened in 1898. That was the first time the shroud was photographed. And when the photographer, whose name was Secondo Pia, began to develop the negatives, he was amazed because what he saw when it began to take shape in the chemicals was that he saw a positive image.
Now, why is that important?
Because the image on the shroud is negative.
So we had a mini miracle in and of itself.
That's how it was perceived. Uh-huh. Yes, and moreover, through the normal process of photography, it was possible to make the image clearer and more pronounced, and thereby everyone could see it immediately.
Now, we could talk, not endlessly, but we could talk, I suppose, John Scott, at great length about the scientific dimensions, the interplay between faith and science when we speak of the Shroud of Turin. You are coming to this relic, this cloth, this text, as it were, from the standpoint of an architectural historian or a historian who's interested in architecture. Why, tell me about that spin that you were putting on this.
Well, yes. I started out on this project for very unglamorous reasons, I suppose. I was interested in the Roman Baroque architect Borromini, who is said to be influential on Guarino Guarini, who designed the chapel in Turin, where the shroud is kept today. Uh-huh. This is a very important late Baroque building, and in the canon of Western architecture, it appears in all the major textbooks.
Now, out of that, you spin an interest in of course you're interested in the Shroud of Turin as an object of faith or speculation, but out of that you spin an interest in the Shroud of Turin from the standpoint of how people see it. Are we on the right track?
That's right. How it's displayed, and also how it's venerated even when it's not actually displayed. The chapel was built very much with the ceremony of the relic and the court ritual that surrounded that in mind.
In other words, it had a political function. What we're moving here now toward is the world of the secular and the political manifestation of something like the Shroud of Turin.
It's important to remember that the relic did not belong to the church, but to the House of Savoy.
Now, this is a very important term or a political entity in the history of modern Europe.
That's right. The House of Savoy, which in the 17th century was a ducal house over the duchies of Savoy and Piedmont, ultimately, in the 19th century, became the kings of Italy.
Did they become the kings of Italy? I mean, because of the Shroud of Turin? Was it that central to political power?
All of the many princely houses of Italy, and you recall that in the Renaissance period, Italy was divided up into various independent political entities, had their relics. And I think it is probably true that no other royal house in Italy, at least, had a relic as impressive as the Shroud of Turin.
Well, now, these people obviously were aware of the power of what they had there in figuratively and literally the House of Savoy. How did they use it?
They exhibited it only occasionally. And this would be usually on the feast day of the Holy Shroud, which is May the 4th. And not every May 4th, but usually to solidify or celebrate important dynastic events such as marriages or births, especially of hereditary princes.
What was the interplay between the politics of the House of Savoy, John Scott, and the Catholic Church itself? Obviously, the Pope would be part of this large picture.
Well, we cannot, in this period, separate very easily the temporal from the spiritual rulers, and certainly the Pope sanctioned the relic and they sanctioned the Savoy ownership of it. And there can be no question, I think, of any kind of modern cynicism here, but that we are talking about people who all deeply believed in the spiritual efficacy of this object.
John, give me a quick word picture of a presentation. You use a Greek term here. Give me that when we speak of displaying the Shroud of Turin.
Well, the term that has been used is ostension, which means simply a showing of the shroud. And the typical kind of ostension that would take place in the late 17th and early 18th century would be in the Shroud Chapel by Guarini. And this chapel is located between the apse end of the cathedral, that is where the altar is located, and the ducal palace. And it could be entered from the palace or from the cathedral. If you're a pilgrim, you go in from the cathedral. If you're the duke, you come in from the palace, of course. The chapel is raised above the floor level of the cathedral, and there is a great stage-like proscenium opening between chapel and cathedral.
So we have a great sense of theatricality here. We
extraordinary have a great scenography, sense of, yes. Uh-huh. And the duke and the court would come in. the relic would be ceremonially taken out of its reliquary. Bishops would hold the shroud extended across in front of the balustrade that looked down over the cathedral.
Did it take a lot of beating during this time? I mean, my sense is that only relatively recently has the Shroud of Turin been the object of scientific care and preservation.
Yes, indeed. One of the reasons for the infrequent ostentions of the shroud in the last few centuries is that the textile is beginning to weaken.
It must be very weak at this point, and that is the rationale behind keeping it, so to speak, under wraps.
Yes, and to help out this problem, it's sewed onto the back of another cloth now.
How is it kept in, as we speak here in the 1990s? You said it's rolled up?
It's rolled up around a staff and then placed in a reliquary box.
And can we expect an ostention anytime soon? How did decisions like this get made?
Well, recently, it has been done on occasions of important anniversaries. For example, there was a major ostension in 1978, which was the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the relic in Turin.
Mm-hmm. Who owns the Shroud of Turin these days? Does it belong to the church?
In 1983, Umberto II, the last pretender to the throne of Italy, who lived in exile, willed it to the papacy.
And how does the Pope in turn make decisions about when and where the Shroud of Turin will be displayed?
Well, I'm not privy to the Pope's decision-making procedures, but I believe that he would rely very much on the advice of the Archbishop of Turin, who is on site and knows all about what's going on with the relic.
One of the interesting elements here, John Scott, is the transfer of authority, so to speak. That is to say, the spiritual power of the Shroud of Turin, in and of itself, becoming associated with this family, the House of Savoy. Tell me about that.
Quite right. Well, remember that in the 17th century, especially, we're dealing with the age of absolutism, and that monarchs claimed their right to rule directly from God. Now, the Duke of Savoy was able to establish this quite visually, because as the relic would be shown to the public, held up by a group of bishops, the entire ducal family would be standing immediately behind it. Not only that, but the duke and the male heirs would be standing directly behind the frontal image, which is, of course, the preferred image of Christ.
Would you say that there was any disparity between the ordinary, everyday conduct of the House of Savoy and the power that the Shroud of Turin imparted to this family? That is to say, in the eyes and minds of ordinary citizens.
Well, I think for the people who were standing down in the cathedral and looking up at an ostension, that this would seem part of the plan of divine providence. Hmm. And the writers about the Shroud in this period speak very directly to this. God gave the Shroud, one of the most important remnants of his passion, specifically to the House of Savoy.
Talk about a politician's dream.
Quite right.
We'd also be talking, John Scott, about not just the serenity of being in the presence of the Shroud of Turin here. We're talking really about managing a lot of people who are going to come and look at this thing. Did things ever get out of hand?
Crowd control was a very troublesome issue. So many people came into the cathedrals for the ostensions that people were crushed and suffocated. And the Duke certainly wanted to avoid this kind of unfortunate situation. So they built great temporary outdoor stages in the public square in front of the ducal palace, where many thousands of people could come on all sides, and the entire court would come out. And in this case, the military and the cavalry and everyone would be down there below the stage. Huh. And the bishops would come out with the Duke, and they would show the Shroud in all directions so that everyone had an opportunity to see it.
Would you say that the Shroud of Turin lost its power to the degree that it declined because of the decline of the political power of the House of Savoy?
I think that the prestigious ownership of the shroud was important in the early years. I'm talking about when the Savoy first obtained it. But eventually, I think as the relic became better known, it gave great prestige in turn to the dynasty, so that they were, we might say, integrally associated in that way.
Do we live, John Scott, in a world of such utter secularity that the Shroud of Turin is no longer an object of great veneration? My sense is that a lot of people still believe in it.
Well, that's right. That is also my sense, Wayne. I think that there is never a final answer on this issue, because what the Shroud shows us about science is that science alone is never 100% certain.
Does that mean that the church willingly cooperates with the scientific community in trying to figure out where the Shroud of Turin came from and how old it is, things like that?
In general, I think that is a fair assessment.
How does that work? Do scientific groups go straight to the Pope himself? Does it all go through the... You mentioned the Bishop of Turin. I suppose he would be important here.
I think that most of the analyses that have been done of the Shroud were initiated by Catholic, or in other words, believing scientists, who wish to use science to demonstrate the truth of faith.
Would this be a question of verifying something that they believe in, or disproving the disbelief of other people?
It seems to me that both would be involved in this thinking.
For the believer who would come to the Shroud of Turin, John Scott, was it a once-in-a-lifetime experience? That is to say, would people have any idea of what this object looked like before they got to it? Were there other representations of the Shroud circulating?
Yes, especially by the 16th and 17th century, the image of the Shroud was widely disseminated through popular media, print media, very affordable, small-scale pieces of paper that one could buy.
This would be the forerunner of our popular publications, even television. I mean, we're not talking just about word of mouth here.
Quite right. Yes. And moreover, the Duke saw to it that images of the Shroud were painted on exterior church walls throughout his realm.
John Scott, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Where do you find yourself in the project that you're engaged on here, that is to say, the architecture of the Shroud of Turin? You're about to publish a book here? You're just beginning the investigation? What?
Yes, I'm currently writing the manuscript of a book which will be on the Shroud, which I call The Architecture of the Shroud, and about the ritual space that was designed for its exhibition.
Is this project, is this going to make any difference to the world of believers or disbelievers? How does it fit into the grand panoply of interpretations of the Shroud of Turin?
Well, what I'm trying to do is to put the physical object in a historical context and step back from the polemics, although, of course, I would like to indicate what those polemics are.
Because that's important to the history.
Indeed. Let me give you an example of that. The Shroud has always been controversial, and already in the 16th century, it was at the center of over the issue of the validity of relics. Protestants in the North did not, on the whole, accept this. Catholics in the South did. And John Calvin even condemned the Shroud in one of his sermons. What's really important to me here is that I wanted to investigate how the object, what was thought about it, and how the ceremony surrounding its public exhibition had impact on architectural design in the late 17th century.
Does it have any impact on our sense of architecture here at the end of the 20th century? Does it exist back there as a historical kind of exercise?
Well, I think the important connection here would be the ritual use of architecture. Hmm. And this doesn't have to be only in religious exercises, but also in political ones. Think of the kinds of ceremonies that take place in the White House Rose Garden with classical architecture, forming the backdrop. This has an important visual component, an important role to play in solidifying crucial moments in diplomatic, political, and sometimes even social history.
Sure, not just the object or the event itself, but the entire visual context that we associate it with, giving it some power.
Mm-hmm. And we can even think of our inaugurations,
sure,
which take place on the steps of the Capitol. And that's crucial for establishing the dignity and the importance of that event, and also the continuity of the occasion.
John Belden Scott is a professor of art history at the University of Iowa. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a new study about the Shroud of Turin. Stay tuned for information about writing for a cassette tape of this discussion. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was John Belden Scott of the University of Iowa. Cassette tapes are available for $10 post-paid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 758. That's number 758. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, another discussion apropos of the Easter season. Historian E.P. Sanders of Duke University will be here to talk about his highly acclaimed new book, The Historical Figure of Jesus. Until next week, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.